history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are men and women around you who have some stories to tell if you just take the time to listen. And we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And it's a pretty unique story we'll hear today from 94-year-old Mel Pliner of Las Vegas, Nevada, but originally from the Big Apple. You grew up in Brooklyn. What was that like?
Right. Well, just like any other kid that grew up in Brooklyn, I went to school at PS 135, public school. Played the usual games, soccer, fixed a roller skate, made me a little cart that I put a apple crate on, and played light touch football from a roll of toilet tissue that we stole from Berkowitz's grocery store. Just the usual kid things that you do when you're growing up.
Do you remember as a boy what your ambitions were? What kind of hopes and dreams or ideas you had about what you were going to be doing in your life?
Well, let me put it this way. My dad was in the steamship laundry business. He had contracts with different steamship companies. And then when their ships would come in from wherever they had been before, he would go aboard and gather the laundry, tablecloths, napkins, cruise laundry, stuff like that. And he would take it to a laundry, having it processed, and then he would get it back to the ship, present a bill to the steward. Steward would take the captain. He would sign it, give him the bill. My dad would take it to the company in town, and they would write him a check. One of the ships that contracts that he had was the Ford Motor Company, and they had a steamship, which actually was diesel-operated. It wasn't steam anymore, named the East Indian. And he got me a job on board the East Indian as the officer's mess boy. At the time, I was 17 years old. We left New York Harbor and went across the grader down to Buenos Aires, Argentina. When we got down there, we unloaded auto parts for an assembly company that they had down there that assembled Ford automobiles. After we unloaded the parts, we took on a load of beans, soybeans. After that, when I got back to Brooklyn, I also had the opportunity when I was 17, 18, and 19 to join what was called the CMTC, Citizens Military Training Corps.
Right.
Which for 2 weeks during the summer months, I could get out of the hot, humid city and I would go upstate New York, 10 Mile River, to a military camp where they trained us in field artillery. We never did fire the 75 millimeters, but we did have 57 millimeter guns mounted on the barrel, which we trained with. They gave us uniforms. We learned how to march, carry a gun, and all that military stuff.
Right.
Did that for 2 weeks out of the year, three times, 17, 18, when I was 19.
And 19 is how old you were in March of 1941 when you decided to enlist in the military. But when they told you it was a six-year commitment, that wasn't what you had in mind.
So I went across the hall to the U.S. Army Air Corps, and I asked him, the guy in charge there, how long is your enlistment? He said, duration and 6 months. I said, sign me up. That's how I got into the U.S. Army Air Corps. It wasn't U.S. Army Air Force yet.
Right.
Okay.
So that's a gamble on your part, because you're saying, if there is a war, I hope it's shorter than 6 years.
Well, if there was going to be a war, I'd be in the Air Force. But I wasn't going to be in the field artillery.
Right.
Okay. Let's see. I signed up on a Tuesday, got my orders on a Wednesday. On Thursday, I was on my way to Camp Dix, New Jersey, across the river. There, I got my uniform, and they started to teach us how to march, carry a rifle, and so forth, which I knew how to do from my CMTC.
Sure.
Okay, after 6 weeks of that, they sent me down to Lawson Field, Fort Benning, Georgia. And after 6 months, I decided to transfer over to the 82nd Materiel Squadron, fixing airplanes, because I was pretty good with my hands. Well, shortly after I transferred over to the 82nd Materiel Squadron, the squadron was then transferred over to an air base near Albany, Georgia, on the other side of Georgia, because we were stationed right on the borderline between Georgia and Alabama.
All right.
And it wasn't long after that, about the first part of 1942, I was in 82nd Squadron, Materiel Squadron, fixing airplanes. I was pretty good at doping fabric and sheet metal, riveting, and that sort of thing.
I got to ask you about a date in 41, because it seems like everybody remembers something about that day, December 7th. Where were you? How did you find out that Japan had bombed Pearl Harbor?
I was still stationed in Laurinburg, Maxon, North Carolina. And a couple of other guys, myself, were taking a trip over to the big city. And on our way back is when we heard about Pearl Harbor. And it was shortly after that, something came out. All military personnel report to the base.
Right.
Their base. That's when I heard about it.
Was it a big deal? Was it a shock? Did you realize what
had happened? We didn't know what it was all about till we got back to base, and then we found out what it was. That was on a Sunday.
Yep.
Monday, Roosevelt got on the radio and declared war.
And you heard that speech there at the base?
Oh, yeah. Well, we all heard that.
Did it fire you up?
Oh, yeah. We figured we're in a war now.
But as you're working on airplanes, you're also thinking, you know, I'd kind of like to fly airplanes?
Let's see. About July, the squadron was transferring over to North Africa in preparation for the invasion of Sicily. And I was being left behind because I was a pretty good scrounger. And I was being left behind with a couple of other guys to start a new squadron. And I figured if I can't go with my outfit, I'll find my own way. So I went to officer's flight school.
All right.
And I said, I'd like to sign up for flight school, learn how to fly airplane. He said, we got a list as long as your arm. I said, well, okay, if I can't go to flight school, I'll go to officer's candidate school. Got there, they said, we got a list longer than your arm. I started back to flight school. When I got there, they had received a Twix telegram looking for volunteers for the glider program. I said, sign me up. This was August of 1942. After I got my papers and so forth, I was sent to Pittsburgh, Kansas State Teachers College, where the college had a small little airport and had a contract with the Air Corps to teach us how to fly airplanes. And there were eight of us in the class. We learned how to fly these puddle jumpers, tail draggers. I got pretty good at it, and I soloed with 7 hours and 45 minutes. I was the first one to solo. And consequently, I had to buy the class when we went to town a round of beers. And beer was a nickel a glass, which I did. From Pittsburgh, Kansas, I was sent to Lubbock, Texas, South Plains Army Flying School, where they had the high-performance sailplanes. Now, have you been to the museum?
I have.
Remember the big sailplanes, high-performance sailplanes hanging up there?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you also saw the puddle jumpers. They got a puddle jumper there.
Yeah, you're talking about the Silent Wings Museum in Lubbock, Texas.
Right.
Which is where you trained, you're talking about right now.
Okay, well, if you were there, then you saw the puddle jumpers. You saw the high-performance sailplanes hanging from the ceiling. The idea was take off and get on tow, which was real simple. Once you get off tow, you got one shot at a landing. It's got to be a good one. You can't give it the gas. Go around again.
Well, and let's make sure everybody gets that, because when you said you volunteered for the glider program, I mean, they told you there weren't going to be any engines in these planes, right?
Well, I knew what gliders were.
Because, I mean, if you tell me you're going to fly an airplane, but you've got no power, no guns, no defenses, and you've got to land that, and you get one shot at it. I don't know if I'd be jumping at that chance. I mean, this is pretty dangerous work.
Well, at that time, my outfit went overseas, left me behind. I figured this might be one way.
You didn't want to miss out.
No, I didn't. I figured my country's in the war now. Mm-hmm. That's the least I can do.
And maybe you understood this right from the get-go, but some folks at home believe it or not, there are a lot of people that don't even know we had gliders in World War II and what they did and the different uses that there were for them. For someone who's uninitiated to the glider program, explain what the idea was and how these gliders were going to be used in combat.
That I'll get along to that. That comes on after I get into it.
Well, you started talking about the towing, so I just wanted to make sure they understood. There's a plane that has to tow you into the air, and then you take it from there.
All right, I'll tell you. The idea behind the gliders were, and the Germans had been doing this prior to our country realizing what the gliders had done for the German troops. So they decided to get into the glider program. But the idea is you take 13 troops in the glider, CG-4As. You could take a Jeep howitzer, 75-millimeter howitzer, or 3,750 pounds load in a glider towed behind a C-47, 20, 30 miles behind enemy lines. Once the glider cuts loose, goes in and lands, the troops jump out. Primarily, the object is a crossroads, a railroad junction. Any way that we, when we get behind enemy lines, is to cut off the supplies, resupplies, ammunition, food, replacements to the enemy that's facing our troops.
Right.
So once we cut off their supplies, no ammunition, no food, no water, no recruits, nothing like that. After 3 or 4 or 5 days, you either give up or get shot. That's the idea behind it.
Right. But just so everyone knows, this plane has no power. Once you land it, you're not taking off in it again, and still got to get back to friendly territory because you're behind enemy lines.
When we landed with combat troops, we were a combat troop, which I'm going to get into later. Okay, I got my orders. When we were flying those high-performance sailplanes, in Texas, they have a lot of dried-up little ponds.
Right.
The sun beats down on the ponds. The heat rises back up as the thermal. Mm-hmm. And I'm flying along, and all of a sudden I feel a lift, and I can see there's a thermal. I just circle around, fly up like that, get up to about 3,000 feet.
Because if you stay off above that tunnel of hot air and keep circling, it'll keep elevating your glider.
Sure. Hot air rises. Mm-hmm. You get into the hot air thermal, and you go up with it, get off, fly around again. After a while, the guys down on the field give me the green light. Get back down. Somebody else wants to fly. So I'd go back in and I'd fly down. Okay.
Okay, well, we need to catch our first break. But when we come back, we're going to move from training into flying that first glider mission as part of the massive Normandy invasion in June of 1944. Find photos of Mel then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.